For 7 years, Cindy James was in a living hell. At the end of those 7 years, she had made around 100 incident reports to police, but during those 7 years, the police weren't sure what to make of her stories and reports, and they weren't really sure what to believe. I'm Reagan Snyder, and this is the very, very mysterious story of Cindy James. After graduating from nursing school, Cindy Makepeace became an administrator for a preschool for children with behavioral and emotional issues in Vancouver, Canada, where she lived, and she was married. She had met her husband, Roy Makepeace, at the hospital she worked at. He was a South African psychiatrist. He had a little bit of an accent, and Roy had left his wife and his two kids to start anew with Cindy. It was now 1982. Cindy was 38 years old, and she was on the road to becoming single again. She and Roy separated amicably about 4 months prior in July after 16 years of marriage. When they went their separate ways, Roy stayed in their home and Cindy went and rented the main floor of a house that was near her work. Cindy and Roy did stay friends, and they would even go on friendly dates to dinner or the symphony and just do things that they enjoyed together. So now it's October 12th, 1982, and Cindy is sitting at her dining room table when her phone rang. And I'm sure it made her eye twitch a little bit because she had been getting threatening phone calls over the last 5 days. She had gotten 8 of them within the last 5 days. And the calls were either somebody breathing heavily into the phone and not saying anything, or somebody speaking in a whispered, threatening tone. They would make sexual and violent comments to Cindy, and in response, she would just hang up. But they kept coming. But this particular one, she did answer it, and this particular one was different. When she picked it up, the person on the other end was direct. They just said, "You're dead, Cindy." So she hangs up the phone and she's freaking out. And she went around her house and made sure that all the doors were locked, the windows, shut all the curtains, and just kind of barricaded into her house the best she could. But that night she got another call. And this time the person said, "Don't think pulling the drapes means that I don't know you're in there." And Cindy didn't know who was doing this. She had no enemies that she could think of. She had no idea who would be harassing her. So she called the police. When they got there, they didn't see any sign of anybody lurking outside her house. They didn't see anybody had tried to break in. So all they could really do was suggest that she start keeping a record of the phone calls and then get an unlisted phone number. Cindy went ahead and took the officer's advice and changed her number, but the calls continued to come in. Cindy was kind of a private person, but she did tell her friends and neighbors about what was going on with her, these calls and the harassment, but nobody really had any information or insight as to who might be doing this to her. She tried to carry on with her life the best she could, and after a night out with her friend Agnes Woodcock, she came home to find that somebody had broken into her house at this point. And rather than going inside, they decided that they were going to go to Cindy's next door neighbor. And this neighbor knew about the harassment, so he offered to go inside ahead of them just to make sure that whoever had broken in wasn't there anymore and it was safe to go inside. So he goes in, he searches all the rooms, he doesn't find anybody. And he's like, "The coast is clear, doesn't look like anybody's in here." So they went inside and they just carried on with their night the best they could. And Agnes was sleeping over. So while they were getting ready for bed, they're in their rooms, changing clothes, doing whatever, brushing their teeth, and Cindy screamed. So Agnes runs in to see what's going on, and she finds Cindy in her room on her bed crying, and she's holding a pillow, and the pillow had been slashed with like a razor or knife or something. They decide that they should probably call the police about this. So the police come, but nothing had been taken. It was clear that whoever had done this was just trying to send a message and scare Cindy. And Pat McBride, who was a constable, suspected that it was Roy, her ex-husband. But he couldn't know for sure. It was just speculation at this point. The calls continued, and Cindy didn't know what to do at this point, so she contacted Roy, because remember, they're still friends at this point. And he came over and comforted her and reassured her. But the next day, while Cindy was at work, somebody had gone into her house again. The people who rented the basement below her knew that Cindy was at work, but they heard somebody walking around upstairs in her house. So they called the police, but by the time the police got to Cindy's, nobody was there. The phone calls kept coming in, and on November 22nd, Cindy finished her work for the day, and she went to get into her car when she noticed something stuck to the windshield. It was a magazine picture, like a picture cut from a magazine of a woman who looked like Cindy with her eyes scratched out. On November 28th, Cindy got another hang-up call, and then 30 minutes later, she discovered that somebody had cut her phone line, but it was only hers. The downstairs tenant's phone was perfectly fine and untouched. She called the police again about this, and they decided to come out and keep watch over her house through the night, but while they were there, there were no other incidents. Pat McBride started to investigate a little bit more, and he discovered that Cindy's neighbor, two doors down, had been receiving similar calls too, and another neighbor reported seeing a man outside of Cindy's house, and they said that he did not resemble Roy. They didn't know who he was. In December, police were still monitoring Cindy's house, and one night they saw Roy circle the neighborhood in his car, and then he pulled up behind Cindy's house and turned off his headlights. So police are like, this seems suspect. And they approached him and they questioned him. They were like, What are you doing? And Roy claimed that he was there to protect Cindy. And they're like, no, she doesn't know you're here. That's weird. You need to leave. Cindy recalled at some point that night waking up to tapping at her window, and when she opened the curtains, she found Roy standing there with a knife and a rifle, and he told her to sleep easy because he was guarding her house. Roy had his own theories and suspicions about what was going on with Cindy and why she was being harassed. He said that they were reminiscent of The Godfather, and whoever was out to get Cindy must have been part of the mafia. His other theory was that she had probably upset a patient of hers and the patient was out for revenge. But let's remember, Cindy works with preschoolers. And unless one of those preschoolers is Chucky, I just don't think that's what's happening here, Roy. He just had some very interesting and bizarre ideas and advice for her. He told Cindy not to use the basement laundry because somebody could easily slip into there and cut her throat, and she wouldn't be found for days. Very specific. Roy asked her to move back in, but she declined. It was the end of December 1982, and while things were good with Roy and Cindy, the relationship was starting to become strained. Cindy had actually started dating Pat McBride around this time. And during one particular visit to Cindy's house, she got another phone call while he was there. Whoever called didn't say anything, but they could hear what sounded like a woman speaking over a PA system. They thought that the call was coming from an airport, but it was eventually traced to a currency exchange in a suburb of Vancouver, and that was it. They didn't figure out who it was or what was going on there. On the night of January 27th, 1983, Agnes Woodcock had plans to come and sleep over at Cindy's house again just to keep her company and comfort her, and they liked having sleepovers. Which blows my mind, because in my 30s, I don't want to be bothered if it means I have to get out of my own bed for the night. Wild. When Agnes got there at around 9:30 p.m. that night, she knocked on the door, but Cindy didn't answer. This was alarming to Agnes because they had plans and she knew what was going on with Cindy. So she started walking around the house and she came upon Cindy. She was outside, she was crouched down, and she had a nylon stocking tied around her neck really tightly. While Cindy was waiting for Agnes to come over, she went out of her house to walk over to the garage to get a box or something. And when she walked outside, there was a man with a knife, and he attacked her from behind, and he held the knife up to her throat and took her into the garage, and there were two other men there waiting. And Cindy couldn't see his face in the darkness. All she was able to get, like, take note of was that he was wearing sneakers. And they told her that if she went to the authorities, they were going to kill her younger sister, Melanie. So when Agnes finds her, obviously, she's ripping the stocking off her neck, and she took her straight to the hospital. And at the hospital, Cindy tried to recount what happened to the doctor and the detective who was there to find out what happened. And she said that the men sexually harassed her, or sexually assaulted her with the knife, and they threatened her, but that was it. That's all she could remember. She couldn't remember much after that. When they examined her body, they found, like, neat little cuts, like with a razor or something, all over her body. They found strangulation marks from the nylons and a needle puncture mark in her right arm. But they didn't find any concrete evidence of sexual assault like she claimed had happened. At this point, Roy is the prime suspect in the case. His alibi was that he had worked late, he got dinner after work, and then he went straight home, getting there at like after 10 p.m. And he agreed to take a polygraph test, but that never went through because apparently he took a medication that could produce false positives, and it just wasn't going to work, apparently. Apparently. After this, the police asked Cindy to see a psychiatrist, but she declined because she didn't want to deal with the stigma attached to seeking mental health help. And so instead, she decided to see a general practitioner. After this assault, Cindy moved. Her friend suggested that she moves into an apartment where it was a little more secure, but she didn't want to give up her backyard. She wanted space for her dog Heidi to run. And so she ended up in another house in West Vancouver. And even after moving, the harassment did not stop. She started getting threatening letters with words cut out from magazines and newspapers at her work. And when she got them, she'd rip them up, and sometimes she would just throw them away without even opening them. And then the calls started up again. And just a couple months after moving, she moved again, trying to escape the harassment and whoever's stalking her. All the while, Roy is trying to reconcile with her. He wants his woman back. So he's showering her with these lavish gifts. He bought her a plane ticket to Indonesia so that she could visit her brother Roger, who was stationed there. And she's like, well, okay, but I'm not getting back with you. So she goes on this trip in July to see her brother. And a few weeks after returning home, she found another note that said, "Welcome back, death, blood, hate, etc." On October 15th of 1983, Cindy heard her dog, Heidi, barking outside. And she went out to see what was going on and what Heidi was barking at. And she found a dead cat with a note next to it that said, "You're next." Unfortunately, Cindy felt like police weren't interested in helping her. They just didn't really know what to make of all of this. They were starting to not believe her. She had had her car painted a different color to try to help conceal her identity. She hired a private investigator named Ozzie Caban, and she started to wear a portable panic button at all times, and she carried pepper spray everywhere she went. So she's just doing what she can, you know? Cindy loved gardening. She had a garden, and she put lots of time and work into it. And one morning, she woke up to find that her garden had been completely destroyed and trampled and dug up. And she thought that Roy was the one who'd done this at this point. He had actually done something similar during their marriage after losing his temper. So it sounds like it's possible that Roy and Cindy didn't just drift apart after 16 years. It sounds like he may have had some abuse issues. During Cindy's marriage to Roy, her coworkers speculated that Roy was abusive. She had come to work with a black eye before, and on another occasion, she came to work with a foot and a leg injury. And when her coworkers asked her about this, she just said she'd heard it playing racquetball. But then she later confided in another coworker named Sue that Roy had actually pushed her down the stairs. So these coworkers, they're not huge fans of Roy. And when they found out that Cindy and Roy were separating, they were happy. They kind of breathed a sigh of relief for Cindy. But Cindy insisted that he wasn't responsible for the harassment. They were still friends. They would still go on dates. And eventually she ended up breaking things off with Pat McBride after a year of dating because she felt like things were moving too fast. So it sounds like it's a push-pull relationship with Roy. Like, she thinks maybe he's doing this, but they're still kind of friends and maybe things aren't quite over there. Who knows? Her PI, Ozzy, had given Cindy a two-way radio. And on the night of January 30th, 1984, there were some weird sounds that were picked up by the radio. So Ozzy went over to her house and knocked on the door, but there was no response. Nobody answered, didn't hear anything in the house. So he started to walk around her house, and he's looking through the windows, and he spots Cindy lying on the hallway floor. Ozzy ran back to his car, contacted the police, and then he went back up to Cindy's front door and he kicked it in. And he shouted, thinking there's an intruder in there. So he's shouting at the intruder, saying he's going to kill him. And nobody's there. And he rushes over to Cindy, and she's unconscious. Her skin was cold and clammy. She had a bump on her head. And worst of all, there was a paring knife stabbed through her hand with a note pinned to it. And the note was just like the other ones she'd gotten. It was cut and pasted from a magazine, and it said, "Now you must die." When the paramedics arrived, they discovered that a black stocking had been tied so tightly around her neck that Ozzy didn't even notice it at first. It was like cutting into her neck, and the folds of her neck were covering it. That's how tight it was. Cindy was taken to the hospital, and doctors ran tests to verify that she didn't sustain any permanent damage, and then they sent her home the next day once she was cleared. And when Ozzy interviewed her, she told him that she had gotten home from work about an hour before the attack. She went to let Heidi out into the backyard, and she saw a man coming through the gate to her house. And initially, Cindy thought it was her neighbor, so she called out to him, but this guy didn't respond. Instead, he started walking quickly towards Cindy, and Cindy just kind of froze in fear. She did note that he had brown hair and blue eyes and was wearing a blue jacket, but that was about it. And he hit her over the head with something, which knocked her out. And the next thing she remembers is waking up on the floor inside her house and thinking that there was another man there with her initial attacker. She vaguely remembered the man putting a needle into her arm. And doctors did find the needle mark, but there were no drugs in her system. After the men left, she crawled over to the radio to contact Ozzy, and that's when he went over there and found her. Cindy took a polygraph test, which showed she was telling the truth, because authorities are getting a little suspicious at this point. It's all just kind of weird. So they have her do a polygraph test, and it showed she was telling the truth, but later on, the officer who conducted the test said that the results, by his estimation, were inconclusive. She hadn't told police the man's description because he threatened that he would kill her sisters if she told them anything, and that freaked her out, understandably, but Ozzy encouraged her to tell the police everything she knew, but she wouldn't do it. She was trying to protect her family. 2 weeks later, detectives questioned Roy. And one of the detectives thought that Roy was responsible for the harassment of Cindy. And the interrogation lasted around 6 hours. And it got heated, but Roy did not crack. He did admit to slapping Cindy on two different occasions while they were married and living together. But he denied ever punching her or pushing her down the stairs. And he told the detectives about his theory that the mafia was after her. So after this intense 6 hours, the police had nothing on Roy and they were forced to let him go. Meanwhile, Cindy went to her parents' house to recover, and when she returned to work, she was feeling better, physically and emotionally. But that summer, it was 1984 at this point, Cindy's harassment just kind of intensified. It reached a crescendo. in intensity. On June 18th, Ozzy got a call from Cindy, and she was in a panic. So he rushes over to her house, and he finds her cowering in the garden, and she told him that somebody had broken into the house. Ozzy went into the house, and in the basement, he found Heidi, her dog, cowering, and around her were sexually explicit photos and a note that said, "Happy birthday." The dog, trigger warning, the dog had been abused, and she was bound by a rope around her neck, and it was the same kind of rope that had been found around the dead cat's neck in Cindy's yard the year before. Remember that dead cat? On the windowsill in the basement, a cigarette butt was found, and Cindy was a smoker, but this particular cigarette butt didn't match the type of cigarettes that Cindy smoked. Ozzy concluded in his investigation that Cindy was not the one to have done this or to hurt her dog. Over the next few weeks, Cindy started getting more of those threatening phone calls at home, and even her coworker got one. And the caller said, "Get rid of the big pig." After this, another dead cat was found inside her house in her stairwell. On July 1st, two men posed as police officers knocked on Cindy's door. And I think she did answer it, but when she radioed Ozzy about it, she was suspicious. So she radioed Ozzy and they took off. And then on July 23rd, Cindy went to take Heidi for a walk. And on the walk, a green van pulled up next to her. And the driver was this guy with long hair and this full beard and square horn-rimmed glasses. And in the passenger seat was a blonde girl. And he asked Cindy, he was just looking for directions. He was asking Cindy where Churchill Street was, and so she's like, "Oh, you just go this way and then you turn here," and she starts giving directions to him. But she was found several hours later at around midnight in a dazed state with another black stocking tied around her neck trying to get into the home of one of her neighbors. And her neighbor helped her. He tried to cut the stockings from around her neck, but it was quite the task because it was tied really tightly. Like it always was. It's like the stalking is always there every time she's attacked. And the dog was okay. She was found later wandering around a park in the area. Ozzy found out what was happening and he came, and Cindy was taken to the hospital by ambulance. And the doctors didn't really know what to make of the whole thing. She had a bloody nose. Her eyes were red and swollen from the stockings being tied around her neck, and she had a sore ankle and two needle marks in her arm. And they ran tests and they did find anti-anxiety medications in her system, like benzos, but they weren't able to uncover how much of it was in her system. When Cindy was undressed, she was getting undressed, there were twigs and leaves in her underwear, but she didn't remember anything about that. She didn't remember anything after giving this man directions. While she was there, the emergency department got a direct call, which bypassed the switchboard, the hospital switchboard, from a man with either a New Zealand or a South American. Did I say Roy was South African? I meant South American. Anyway, the hospital got a call from a man with either a New Zealand or a South American accent. And he was asking if the hospital had security. He asked what time the emergency department closed, which it didn't, and how many floors the hospital had, or that department had. And the receptionist was getting confused, and she was getting weird vibes, so she told him she was just going to transfer him, just put him on somebody else. Somebody else can deal with him. But when she told him that, he hung up the phone. So the receptionist went over to the authorities in Cindy's room, and she's like, "Hey, I just got this really weird call I thought you should know about." And when they talked to her about it, they played audio of Roy's voice for her, and she was like, "It sounds similar to whoever called. There's a strong possibility that it could have been him, because remember, Roy is South American and he has that accent." In October of that year, Cindy agreed to see a hypnotherapist because they wanted to try to dig up some of these memories that just of her attacks. Like she remembered bits and pieces, but she wasn't remembering the full picture. And from her latest attack with the guy in the green van, she was able to recall certain features about the van. It had chrome mirrors. It had a carpeted interior. So she's like, oh my gosh, I was inside the van. She remembered being dragged inside and she saw several people inside the van. So not just the guy and the blonde lady in the front, but like there are a few in the back. And one was wearing a mask and a wig. During her second hypnotherapy session in January of 1985, she recalled another memory from the summer of 3 years prior. So before all of this started, she had taken a trip with Roy on their boat. The Peacemaker is what it was called. And they sailed about 47 miles from Vancouver to this very isolated area of the Gulf Islands. And after docking the boat, Roy took off to go look at some properties on the island while Cindy stayed behind and took a nap in the lower deck of the boat. And when she woke up, there was shouting. So she went up to the main deck and she started shouting back, but nobody responded. So she left the boat, she got off the boat, and she's trying to investigate. And as she walked further and further inland, she came upon this log cabin. She went up to the front porch and she knocked on the door, but nobody answered. So she opened the door and she saw Roy standing there, and he was looking angry. He was holding a knife covered in blood, and on the floor were a woman in her 20s and a man in his 30s. And at this sight, Cindy just puked everywhere. She ran away. She's screaming at Roy that he's a murderer, and he caught up to her and slapped her and shook her. The next thing that she remembered after that was sitting on the bed of the boat, feeling numb, as Roy hacked the bodies and threw them into the water. Detectives used this new memory as a lead, and Cindy recalled the cabin's interior in great detail. So the detectives tried to find the cabin, but it was a difficult task because Cindy didn't really know where they had docked. She didn't really know the area. She described it as best she could. So police took what she gave them and went out for a full day and they searched, but they never did find that cabin. They investigated further and they did not find evidence of any murders or missing person cases in that area at the time. Police asked Cindy if they could tap her phone and have her call, make a call to Roy. And she hadn't spoken with Roy for a while, but she agreed to do it. And on July 2nd, 1985, she called him on a tapped phone. She told him that she'd been undergoing hypnotherapy and that she remembers everything. She told him she wanted to talk to him about it before going to the police. She recalled all the events to him about how she remembered the cabin and that she thought he was responsible for the attacks on her. And he was shocked and angry at all of this. And of course, he denied all of it and told Cindy that she was insane and involved in some enormous revenge fantasy. For the next 5 days, both Cindy and Roy were placed under 24-hour surveillance. But during this time, Roy didn't even attempt to contact Cindy, let alone hurt her. Soon after this surveillance holiday, Cindy got a package at her home with a dark pair of nylons and a note that said, "Blood flowing freely." On July 27th, she found a cosmetics container that had raw, decomposed meat from a small animal. In August, she reported two fires in her home. Not one, but two. To the police within 2 days of each other. A couple weeks later, on August 21st, a third fire broke out. It was in Cindy's basement bathroom, and it was at around 4:45 a.m. So firefighters and police arrive on the scene, and they found Cindy having a heated discussion with Ozzy about where she had been at the time the fire started, and she told him that she had taken the dog out for a walk at 3:15 a.m., which seems a little bit suspicious, Cindy, girl. And when she got home, she discovered that her house was on fire. Authorities investigated, and they found that the window to the bathroom was ajar in the basement, but the soot and the dust on the windowsill didn't show any signs of an intruder entering or exiting through it. They found charred pieces of newspaper in the bathroom, and a detective on the case thought that Cindy had started the fire herself. A psychologist named Dr. Anthony Marcus was requested by the police department to conduct some interviews with Cindy and just to examine the various case files that she was involved with over the past few years. And so he did. And in his professional opinion, Cindy may have been suffering from dissociative identity disorder stemming from a traumatic childhood incident, although he never did question her about her childhood during their interviews. And DID, dissociative identity disorder, is also known as multiple personality disorder, and it's characterized by the presence of at least two personality identities, and each personality might have a unique name, a personal history, and characteristics that are unique to that personality. Possibly. Cindy moved to a new house after this in Richmond on December 1st, and 10 days later, she left work at her lunch break, but she never came back. That night at around 6 p.m., a woman named Desiree was riding her bike near the University of British Columbia when she saw Cindy staggering before falling into a ditch. So Desiree goes over to her to help her, and she sees that she has a black stocking tied around her neck. And Desiree was able to, she ran over and ripped the stocking off of her with her bare hands. She was able to get it off, and she called an ambulance. Medics arrived to find Cindy standing in the ditch still. In a daze, there was freezing water up to her thighs, and in addition to her normal clothes, she was wearing a men's work boot and a single glove on her right hand. They coaxed Cindy out of this freezing cold water, and they took her to the hospital to be evaluated for hypothermia, among other things. She had scratches on her chest, legs, arms, and back, and they looked like that they were caused either by somebody scratching her with their fingernails or tree branches. She had a dark bruise on her forehead. She had a puncture wound in the crook of her elbow, which indicated that she had been drugged. And labs showed more benzos in her system. But Cindy had told the doctor that she'd taken 6 milligrams of Ativan earlier that day for anxiety. Again, she didn't remember much about what happened. She remembers leaving work at lunch to pick up her Ativan prescription, and the next thing she remembered after that was going to the hospital. She vaguely remembered being in an unfamiliar room and having her hands tied up, but that was about it. And she was feeling like police didn't believe her. She left the hospital, and shortly after the attack, she went back to work. But her coworkers could see that she was struggling. She was further withdrawn. Her stress was at an all-time high. It was overwhelming enough to cut into her ability to handle her workload. After this particular attack, things seemed to slow down for a bit, and Cindy was starting to find joy in her new home and in her garden. And at this point, she formally changed her last name from Makepeace to James. And James was her ex-husband's last name. That's where that came from. And she did this in hopes of concealing her identity. In April of 1986, which was about 4 months after the attack in December, Cindy's friends Agnes and Tom Woodcock came over to her house to hang out and play some cards. They would sometimes spend the night at Cindy's house just to help ease her fears, and on this night they decided that they would stay with her. At 2 a.m., Tom heard a loud thump coming from downstairs, and just as he was getting out of bed to put on his shirt and go investigate, Cindy knocked at his bedroom door and told him that she heard the thump. So they went downstairs together to investigate, and when they got down, they discovered that another fire had been set, and Tom shouted at Agnes to call 911. So Agnes rushed over to the phone, but the phone was dead. Tom raced outside looking for help, and when he came outside, he saw a man about in his 30s standing near Cindy's house on the sidewalk, and Tom's like, hey, can you call 911? There's a fire. And the man just looked at him. He didn't respond. Instead, he took off running down the street and just disappeared. the fire department showed up and the fire was extinguished within the hour of it starting at 2:52 a.m. Cindy, Heidi, and the Woodcocks were all unharmed, and all the damage that had been done was confined to the basement. Authorities began an investigation, but they were unable to find any evidence to point them to a suspect. Cindy had her own theory, though, and she thought Roy was to blame. After this, Cindy's mental health was on a serious decline. She realized that no matter where she went, where she moved to, what she did, the trouble would follow her. She refused to eat. She made comments that her life was no longer worth living. And her psychiatrist, Dr. Alan Connolly, was scared that she was suicidal. So he had her committed to the psychiatric unit of St. Paul's Hospital, where she stayed for 2 weeks. And while she was there, it was observed that she was suffering from anorexia and depression. And after the 2 weeks of being there, she was transferred to Riverview Hospital, and they did a comprehensive psychological exam on her. She ended up staying there for 10 weeks, and she showed significant improvement and was released from the hospital. After her stay at the hospital, it was June 1986, and she finalized her divorce from Roy, and she felt like she was doing good. She was doing better. She felt like she had been presented with a new beginning. She went to visit her brother Roger again, who was now in Germany, in July. And when she returned home, she felt like she was well enough to go back to work. She had been on leave for 6 months and she was ready to go back. But when she got back, she was asked immediately to resign. While she was gone, they felt that she was not coping well enough to continue on as their director. And this was devastating to her. She had been there for 13 years and it was coming to an end, but she was given a severance and they paid for her to upgrade her skill set to become a hospital ward nurse. And in August of 1987, she took a job at Richmond General Hospital in the ICU recovery ward. And the change was a lot for Cindy. It caused her a lot of anxiety. She was losing sleep. She was losing weight. Her weight dropped down to 97 pounds. And she was relying heavily on her anti-anxiety medication. On August 28th of that year, her home alarm was triggered when a back window was broken. And 3 days later, she reported to the police that her front porch light bulbs had been loosened. Seems so petty. Poor Cindy. The next week, she reported that someone had used a glass cutter to create a hole in the basement door window. In February of 1988, someone had shattered one of the windows to her house. It's just never ending. They're just bothering her like nothing came of the shattered window. They just shattered it to shatter it. Her psychiatrist thought that it would be a good idea for her to start keeping a diary of all of her thoughts. And one of the entries in it from April 30th of 1988 said, "Got a hang up call about half an hour after getting home. Don't know if it's that or what, but I feel kind of jittery. Hope there aren't any more for the next few days, as that seems to have been a pattern before my house was broken into each time. Maybe I'll take a taxi to work on Monday night so it doesn't look like the house is empty. I'm so sick of this. I'm so tired of living in fear. I'm so bloody tired, period. I'm so tired of being tired." Cindy wrote a lot in her diary about her anger. She was upset with her parents for her strict upbringing. She was mad at Roy for controlling her during their marriage. And she was mad at the police because she felt like they were brushing her off. On October 9th, 1988, Roy was at his home when two men buzzed his apartment from the front of the building. And he didn't recognize them, so he just ignored them. But then just a few minutes later, he got a knock at the door, and it was those two men. Somebody had let them in. And Roy was not about to answer the door with everything that was going on, so he just ignored them, and they finally left after about an hour. 2 days later, though, Roy came home to two weird messages on his answering machine. One of them was this intentionally raspy voice saying, "Cindy, dead meat soon." The other one said, "More smack, more downers, another grand after we waste her, no more deal." Roy gave the tapes to his attorney instead of the police because he thought that the police would target him as a suspect, and he didn't feel like dealing with that. On October 26th, after a long 13-hour shift, Cindy pulled into her garage and she turned off the car and she just sat there and listened and watched. She had made it a habit to just wait for a minute before she got out of her car for a few minutes just to acclimate to her surroundings and make sure that there was nothing amiss. Nobody was there. She didn't hear anything. And when she got out of the car, she was approached by two men in ski masks. One of them grabbed her and held a knife to her neck, telling her that he would kill her. Well, Cindy had a silent alarm, and she was able to trigger it and alert Ozzy before they pressed a needle into her arm. 2.5 hours later, Ozzy got word from the alarm company that Cindy's silent alarm had been triggered, and a police officer finally responded after midnight. And when they got there, everything seemed to be calm and quiet. So the officer walked up the driveway to the open garage, and he saw that the interior lights in Cindy's car were on. And when he approached the car, he found Cindy in the driver's seat, and she was unconscious. She was naked from the waist down, and she had been hogtied and left with black stockings tied around her neck, duct tape over her mouth, a bloody nose, and the silent alarm device in her hand. The officer checked for a pulse and he wasn't able to find one, so he came to the conclusion that Cindy James was deceased. So he calls this in, he calls for backup, and when the responding officer got there, he heard Cindy wheeze. And so they're like, oh, she's alive. So they untied her as quickly as they could, and she was taken to the hospital ICU where she worked. While she was in the ICU, she fell into a coma, and the neurologist was worried that she may have a brain injury. So he had her transferred to another hospital where she was intubated and she was given a series of brain scans, and they all revealed that she was fine. She hadn't suffered any permanent damage. Cindy did eventually regain consciousness, and when she did, Richmond police questioned her pretty extensively this time. Detectives were starting to recognize a pattern in Cindy's case. There would be periods of time where nothing happened, and then the phone calls would start up, and then attack would occur, and then the threats would go away. And it was rinse and repeat, just a cycle of craziness. And it seemed like whoever was doing this to her was more interested in torturing and harassing Cindy than actually taking her life. On April 8th, 1989, a security guard at Richmond General Hospital, where Cindy worked, found a note on the premises with letters cut from a magazine, cut and pasted, that said, "Soon, Cindy." And in the dew on her windshield of her car, it said, "Sleep well." On May 25th of that year, Cindy was doing better. She was in good spirits. She was enjoying her first of 5 consecutive days off of work. And she went to get coffee with a fellow nursing friend named Diane. She had a makeover at the salon. She went to work to pick up a paycheck, and everybody who saw her that day noted that she was in bright spirits. And at some point during the day, she had made plans with Tom and Agnes to come over to her house that evening to play bridge. At 9 p.m., Tom and Agnes showed up at her house, but she wasn't there. And this was alarming to them. So they got back in their car and they started driving around hoping that they'd be able to find her. At some point they did. They spotted her car. It was a blue Chevrolet and it was parked at a bank. So they pulled into the parking lot and they approached her car and found that it was locked, but the keys were on the front seat and there was a small trickle of blood running down the inside of the driver's door, but Cindy wasn't there. She was nowhere to be found. So they called the police, and inside of Cindy's car, the police found 4 bags of groceries, her purse, a croquet set with some wrapping paper that was intended for a friend's son's birthday, and underneath the car were contents of her wallet, including an ATM card with a receipt wrapped around it, and that showed that Cindy had deposited her paycheck from that day at around 7:58 p.m. that night. The place that Cindy's car was parked at stood out to Agnes because she knew, with everything going on, Cindy would always park as close as she could to the ATM. And if she needed to wait for a spot to become available, she would do that. Within a few hours, officers were at Roy's house questioning him. It's like 3 in the morning at this point, And he told police that he had taken his bike to the market with his friend the previous night. And when police told him that Cindy was missing, Roy teared up and whispered, "My gosh, she's dead." A search on foot with bloodhounds was launched, but they came up with nothing. They weren't any closer to finding Cindy, but they did verify that the blood on the door of her car was hers. A search on Cindy's house was conducted, but nothing out of the ordinary was found besides a bunch of prescription sedatives. So things like Xanax. And Cindy was known to use these to help her sleep, but it looked like she was hoarding them. There were like over 900 pills in her house that they found. Several days after her disappearance, a call came into Cindy's insurer. He claimed to be Cindy's father, and he was inquiring about her life insurance policy. And when he was told that he would have to come into the office to discuss this, the caller hung up. Cindy's father was asked about this, and he denied ever making that phone call. And the guy that talked to him said whoever did make the call sounded a little bit older, and he had a slight accent. Exactly 2 weeks to the day after Cindy's disappearance, on June 8th, a municipal paving worker needed to take a pee break, and he walked to an abandoned house nearby, and behind the house, he stumbled upon Cindy. She was hogtied with a rope in the fetal position. She had a black stocking wrapped tightly around her neck, and it was obvious that she had been dead for some time because her body was decomposing. An autopsy determined that Cindy had died of an overdose of morphine, diazepam, and flurazepam. She had 10 times the lethal dose of morphine in her system. They also found that she had orally ingested about 20, 30 milligram tablets of flurazepam on top of multiple diazepam pills. They were unable to determine how the morphine got into her system. There were trace amounts of it in her stomach, which meant that it could have been administered intravenously. If that were the case, then she would have been unconscious within minutes and dead within hours. About a month after Cindy was found, her family was notified that her death was ruled a suicide, and police were no longer investigating the case. A memorial service was held for her on June 14th, 1989, 2 days after what would have been her 44th birthday, and Roy was not in attendance. After this, there was a 40-day inquest into Cindy's death in the spring of 1990. There were 5 jurors, and there were over 80 witness testimonies. During the inquest, Roy made accusations against Cindy's family that her father had physically abused her throughout her childhood, and that one of her brothers even molested her. Psychiatrists and psychologists who had treated Cindy over the years testified that she suffered from either borderline personality disorder with PTSD elements or from hysterical personality disorder. And one of the psychiatrists believed that there was a strong chance that Cindy's father had sexually abused her when she was a child, even though she never indicated that this was the case. There were attempts to determine whether or not Cindy could have hogtied herself in the position that she was found. They even had a knot expert who knew knot experts existed, but he had demonstrated in the court that she could have done it within 3 minutes before the narcotics in her system took hold. Ultimately, the jury was unable to determine whether her cause of death was a suicide, a homicide, or accidental. It was ruled that she died of an unknown event, and the case was closed. Cindy's family didn't believe this. They did not believe that she took her own life. And so, we the people are left to speculate what happened to Cindy James. When her PI, Ozzie Caban, examined her body at the morgue, he discovered that the settling of her blood post-mortem was on the left side of her body, yet she was found laying on her right side. And this would indicate that she had died somewhere else before being moved to the abandoned house where she was found. There are theories out there that Roy Makepeace was responsible for her harassment and death. And in this theory, Roy was involved in drug smuggling, and he was working with a mafia operation, which Cindy may or may not have known about or even been involved with. and this could have had something to do with the cabin. And if this is the case, it's speculated that that Roy drugged her. Supposedly, they did find the cabin after the inquest. I don't know how true that is, but from what I read, they did, and there were a lot of blood stains inside. It's possible that after Cindy divorced Roy, she became a liability, and she was being stalked and harassed to keep her from talking, to scare her out of talking. And she didn't give police all the information she knew, remember? So maybe that's what all the needles were all about. She remembered being poked with needles. Maybe they were drugging her. And perhaps her death was an accidental overdose. Because, I mean, this torture went on for 7 years. And it looked as if that's what they were trying to do, was just harass her and torture her and scare her. They weren't trying to kill her. Because, I mean, 7 years is a long time. If they wanted to kill her, it seems like they would have. And remember, Roy was a psychiatrist. He would have had access to these drugs to sedate Cindy. And all of it started 4 months after they separated. And remember that time police caught him sitting in his car at Cindy's house without her knowledge? That's suspicious. It's also possible that he could have used his knowledge in psychiatry to play mind games with her and with those involved. But then there's the dissociative identity disorder theory. Is it possible that Cindy was unknowingly tormenting herself? Was it a combination of both? Listen to this clip. It's one of the threatening messages that Cindy got. Does it sound like a man, or does it sound like a woman trying to make her voice deeper? Maybe it's Cindy. This is a case that you have to absolutely comb through and dissect to form a theory. I kind of wish I would have done this in parts to just cover everything, because it's such a big story and there's so much to it and it's so interesting and it's such a mystery. Either way, it's unlikely that we'll ever know what happened exactly to Cindy James, but we can hope for her family's sake that one day they can get answers.